Yeah, I feel kind of weird standing in this huge auditorium speaking to six people from behind a little... Some of what you're about to hear is just basic common sense, and some of it will probably be biblical common sense turned in a way that's sort of new. So let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord God, you're the original storyteller. You told us the story. You ask us to faithfully pass it on to others. Pray that you'd give us wisdom to do that and help this next 40 minutes in some way be a useful tool for equipping these folks to go back and tell your story. In Christ's name, amen. We're all born knowing that it's all about us, right? It's the first thing any baby, well, it's not the first thing any baby learns because no one needs to learn it. The movie is about me. It starts when I, you know, when I wake up. It stops when I go to sleep. Nothing happens when I'm not in the, you know, when I'm not in the room. Close the refrigerator. The light goes off. There's nothing important happening in there. And it's not true. And we also think that we're the hero of the story, and that may turn out not to be true either. Not only it will turn out not to be true that you are not the hero in the story, but depending on what sort of person you turn out to be, you may not be a hero at all. You may be not you, you, other people may be the villain, may be the well-meaning, pompous idiot that everybody sort of laughs at behind their back. That never really accomplishes anything. The well-intentioned but morally flawed person that just struggles to get, you know, to get out of the mud and never quite makes it. All these characters are in the story, and nobody gets a, you know, gets a pass when they're born that says you're not going to be that person. And everybody in this room is old enough to have had those moments where you suddenly realize, I opened my mouth and that person came out. How did that happen? When you're seeking to change someone's understanding of the story that they're living in, this is a major character-forming thing. And it's not, it's simple, but it's not easy. The real story, the story that we all live in, starts with let there be light. And before that, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's where the story starts. The story doesn't have an ending. It continues from in the beginning was the Word to let there be light to and God saw everything that He'd made, that it was good to out you go and shut the gate behind you. Right up to the present day, right onto the last judgment and past it. There is no end to this story. And your life doesn't make sense except in that story. If you're not reading your life in that story, it's like walking into the room in the middle of a conversation or making the awful mistake of getting a medium drink when you go to the movies. And the medium drink turns out to be the popcorn tub with soda in it. And you swill the whole sucker down in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And by the time you hit the 40-minute mark, you're dying. And so off you go to the bathroom, and you come screaming back in, and nothing makes any sense. Why? No context. You lost the thread of the story. And you have an opportunity, as you work with small children especially, you have an unparalleled opportunity to ruin them for life and make it so that they always think in terms of the story, the whole story. I'm on my probably seventh major trip through teaching the Bible chronologically, from creation all the way to the end. I've taught adults, I've taught little kids. I'm working with, this go-around is with middle schoolers, and we're designing my partner and I are also designing a sixth grade Bible curriculum for a Christian school up near us that came to us out of the blue a few weeks ago and said, we need a sixth grade Old Testament curriculum, we need it yesterday, and can you help? Yes, of course we can. How are we going to do this? So we're doing it. So I know a little bit about this, and mostly it's not about lesson plans. Mostly it's not about the best stuff happens when you're not planning it, and it just walks into you anyway. It's mostly about character. It's about who you are and how conscious you are of your place in the story. This is a way of reading your life and other people's lives that puts it into context. So it's mostly about who you become more than, you know, I can give you lesson plans. And if you want them, my website's at the bottom of the page. There's a contact form there. Send me an email. Ask me for stuff. I'll give you anything I can. I'll help you any way I can. But mostly this is about, the first thing is you tell the big story all the time. So if you're doing David and Goliath, one of the things that we do as we work our way through, we tell all the common stories and some of the not so common ones, but we never lose the thread, so that if we're telling David and Goliath, we talk about, you know, this is not, you know, the Raiders against the Broncos. Well, go Broncos, because they're our people. Israel against the Philistines is not that kind of a deal. Well, you know, what? David kills Goliath. Why is that a good thing instead of a bad thing? How do you think it made Goliath feel to have a stone thrown through his head? Would you like it if someone did that to you? You bring this stuff to the table without thinking about it. And small kids especially will pick that stuff up without knowing they're picking it up. Their affinities are your affinities because they're learning that along with everything else. But make the story make sense. These are God's people. God told these people, live in this land. There's other people who are trying to rule over them, who are trying to oppress them. And that's where Goliath comes from. And David comes from God's people. And David says, God told us to live here. God told us that we have a right to be here. Who's that guy? What's he doing? Somebody shut him up. I'll do it. And put into that context, then also different applications start to come out of it. It's not just something big and discouraging, but God can help you do it. It's when you're facing this big and discouraging thing, did God put you there? Is this something God's actually asking you to do? We have a few in our youth group, and I'm sure you've known a few as well, who have a tendency to take on large and discouraging things because they like to fight. And you tell the David and Goliath story, and they're right with you all the way. And when you want somebody to take that bit of t-shirt and two strings and sling an eraser at the big paper giant on the wall, they're right up there to do it. but it's because they like winning fights. It's got nothing to do with God calling them to do anything. And so as you tell the whole story, and you situate the little stories into the big story, you get a different set of applications. You get the ones that you were going to get anyway, but you also get, did God ask you to do this? How do we, you know, why do we care that David was the good, you know, how do we know that David's the good guy? Because he's little? Is it always, if the little guy picks the fight with the big guy, is the little guy still the good guy? Well, God asked him to be there. Did God ask you to go pick this fight? The problem with trying to tell the big story all the time is that it takes too long. The Bible's a big book. If you're going to start in Genesis and you're going to go right on through to Revelation, but you got 20 minutes and it's supposed to be about David and Goliath, what you going to do? The way that you pare down is by working with what theme are you tracing? What's the theme that you're going to the David and Goliath story highlights? God likes doing impossible things is one of them. Facing something impossible, God can do that. You want to trace that theme? You can start with creation. Easy. In the beginning, there was nothing. God said, let there be light. Bing! Light. God divides it, light from darkness, day and night, shapes the whole world, makes everything that you see. How's that for doing the impossible? David knocking down a 9-foot-tall giant with a rock doesn't, you know, it's small potatoes, let's face it. And you can tell the story that way. Run through Abraham's how old, and he has a child. It's impossible. Nobody does that. But there it is. You can start at creation. And this can be very, very quick. Everything that you see, all the trees you saw on your way here tonight, God made those. God said, trees, and there were trees. God made people, put them in the garden, gave them a job to do. They failed. God kicked them out of the garden. Along the way, he continued to call people. He called Abraham and said, Abraham, I want you to go out from your family. I want you to go to a place I'm going to show you. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to give it to your descendants. Abraham doesn't have any children. He gets fantastically way too old to have kids. His wife is way too old to have kids. He says, God, I'm going to give this to my what? And God gives him a child. And God gives them that land. And God tells them to take possession of that land and to prosper in it. And here comes Goliath and the Philistines, oppressing them in the land that God put them in. That's what, 5 sentences? And what are David and Goliath? 5 sentences, a couple of impossible things, and now we have another impossible thing that God's going to do, and that's what the story for tonight is about. You could do it different. You could do a different theme entirely. You could do the being on God's side. God made everything that we see, planted a garden, put a man and a woman in the garden, and said, I want you to protect this and guard it. And the first time the devil walks into the garden and says, hey, let's do things differently, they go for it. God says, fine, out of the garden with you. And we have this continuing struggle. Will we be on God's side or not? Will we do what God calls us to do, or will we be against the people who are doing what God calls us to do? And you can walk through the story that way. God calls people even outside the garden to walk with him, and they refuse to the point that there's only one guy in his family left who will walk with him. And God says, fine, you know what? I'm going to scribble over this thing and start over. He goes to that one guy and says, build an ark. He builds an ark. They laugh at him. God floods the world. Now, you'd think these people would walk with him, but do they? No, of course not. But you have a few. You always have a few. And then you can do Abraham, one of the descendants of these people. In Ur of the Chaldees, worshiping idols, God comes to him and says, I want you to get out of here. Go to a place I'm going to show you. He goes. Along the way, part of his family gets kidnapped. And he has to go and take his servants and go rescue his nephew Lot from being kidnapped in the course of the war. He's given the land, but he's never able to live in it. When he dies, the only piece of property that he actually owns is the grave where his wife is buried. And God takes his whole family down into Egypt, where they become slaves for 400 years. And then God says, come out. God says to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, let him out. He won't do it. God destroys Egypt and leaves it a smoking ruin and brings his people out, gives them this land, says, live here, worship me. And they go after idols. They worship other gods. They won't listen. And so repeatedly they find themselves oppressed by different people. And then finally, they begin to worship God. And in one of the bright spots where they're actually worshiping God for a change, here comes Goliath. Different theme, different selection of material, you get to the same place quickly. And I say this not to... I've done this a lot. I just picked those examples out of a hat. I had no idea I was going to use David and Goliath when I planned this talk. You spend enough time working with the story and you don't need a lesson plan. And that's a place that as Christians we want to get to, because lesson plans don't help in the really juicy situations where in the teaching moments that God just providentially causes to happen right in front of you. He doesn't tell you the night before that it's going, at least, well, he doesn't tell me anyhow. So I find myself in it with whatever I brought. And the more of the story we have, the easier it is to deal with. Knowing, for example, we had this come up 2 weeks ago. One of my students asked, so what if, like, I believe in Jesus now, but then later I go out and kill somebody. What then? Am I going to hell? We'd taught enough of the story that we could answer that with a question. What happened to David? He knew the answer. Part of the reason he knew the answer is because we've taught that story. Part of the reason he knew the answer is we sing Psalm 32 most weeks, which is David's meditation on looking back on that time in his life and his meditation on how God cleansed him when he confessed his sin. Drilling in, if you're going to be that person, the first thing and the biggest thing is to read. I've got a list of books there: Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Luke, Acts, Revelation. It doesn't have to be Luke. It could be Mark or Matthew. But those books are a chronological thread that goes right on through the Bible. Everything else fits in around them. So, for example, Ruth takes place during Judges. Esther takes place during Daniel. 1 and 2 Chronicles take place during the time, during the monarchy. 1 and 2 Chronicles take place during 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, during the monarchy. It's a parallel history, emphasizing different things. Picking up where the parallel stories fit in comes second, but getting that backbone down is first. A lot of my good teaching moments are Proverbs kinds of things. Evil company corrupts good morals is one of those things that I find myself using a lot, and you probably do too, one way or another. The Proverbs, many of them are digests of themes that you find over and over and over and over and over again in the story. How many people in the story, how many characters in the story get corrupted by bad company? And you can see that with learning the Proverbs not just as moral advice with which to make good little boys and girls, which is fine. I like good little boys and girls as much as the next person. But part of the reason we teach with our group, we have what you might call them, with my middle schoolers, we have what you might call a missional youth group. None of these kids go to church. None of their parents go to church. When we're at a multiple youth group gathering and somebody comes running in and says, they're smoking pot behind the dumpster, my partner and I go out because we know it's going to be one of our kids. if there's that kind of trouble to be had, one of our kids is in the middle of it somewhere. That's just the way it goes. My partner was sitting working with some of these kids in a small group, and he realized he had the answers to the dilemmas, the stories, and the problems that they were bringing to the table. But he could give them the advice, but they wouldn't know why they should take it. They didn't understand why it made sense. And it was going back to Genesis with them, taking them through the story, and situating them then with, shall I hang out with this person or with this person? Well, what are you going to do with this person? Well, probably sit around and smoke pot until we run out, and then, I don't know. Well, what are you going to do if you go to this hang out with this group of people? Well, they're all football players, so I'll probably go out for the football team. Well, if those are your choices, and we all know, yeah, go out for football. I'll run with you. We'll make it happen. But why? This is easier. That's a lot of work. Yeah, those guys are cool. They're popular. It's fun. But this is really easy. And it's fun, too. Fun. Yeah, flip a coin. Why does it make sense? Well, you can do the basic things come very easily. At the end of this story, you stand in front of Jesus and explain why you hung out with these people rather than those people. Now, what do you think he's going to say? But sometimes that's not enough. Because with most people, their idea of what Jesus would do is their idea of what Jesus would do. If they don't see anything wrong with smoking pot or bullying somebody or spreading rumors about a friend behind their back, then, what's the problem? I'm just having a little innocent fun.
Or they feel just ask for forgiveness.
Sure. I know he's going to forgive me, right? Yes. What happened to David? Oh, this is the other side of rooting it in the story. What did happen to David? Well, his son died. God said, the sword will never depart from your house. After which, and this is where, probably we're out of the TNT range here, but this is where you tell the ugly bits of the story. The Absalom story you could tell. What you probably aren't going to tell your third graders is the reason why Absalom decided Dad needed replacing. Which is, backing up a little bit, Amnon starts looking at his half-sister Tamar and going, I'd really like a piece of that. So he devises a plan. He rapes her. Dad does nothing about it. Absalom, Tamar's sister, murders him in cold blood for raping his sister. David exiles Absalom. Absalom, after some time, is allowed to come back and begins hanging out in the gate, meeting people who are coming in to request justice from the king and saying, "Oh, I'm sorry nobody can help you. Man, if I were king." And the whole thing, that whole thing happens because David didn't do anything about Amnon and Tamar. And that whole thing happened because David cheated on his wife and then murdered Uriah. And so these, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe this story is in the Bible" moments within the whole story makes sense. David winds up losing 3 of his sons out of this. People died because he wouldn't just walk with God and make good on a promise to be faithful to his, well, in this case, wives. So, when you stand before Jesus to explain why you didn't keep your promise to your friend, what do you think he's going to... Now what do you think he's going to think of your pet, your weak little excuse? This is what happens when people don't keep their promises. What do you think he's going to say? And then layering into that, and David's a really good example for this, layering into that the Psalms as well, because they give you the juicy stuff. We talked about this last hour, but you get all kinds of good stuff in the Psalms. Like Psalm 13 starts off asking God why he's, you know, "God, why have you forgotten me?" These are things you can't say in church. I mean, how many, you know, realistically, honestly, how many of you would just have a heart attack if you've got a few minutes left after you've done sections, and you just say, "You know what, let's just pray a little." That's a good old standby, right? Kill a few minutes until council time. So we're going to pray, and you're going around the circle, and one of your students just says, "God, I don't know why you forgot me, but I hope you remember me soon." This is not beyond the realm of possibility. You've been there. And it's in the Bible. There are points in the story, you know, David's running around caves in the wilderness because Saul's trying to kill him. He's been anointed king, but, you know, good luck with that. The current king is, you know, has got a spear with your name on it. Does he feel like that? Sure. The Psalms don't leave us where they pick us up. He starts with, "Why have you forgotten me?" And he keeps going downhill until he hits, "If you don't get me out of this, I'm going to die." Which sounds, you know, sounds like we're just continuing the downer streak, but that's the point you need to hit. God, it's you or nobody. I can't do it. Nobody else can do it for me. Either you get me out of this or I'm done. And then he thinks about what a blessing that would be to some people, and how his enemies would rejoice if he died, and dance on his grave. But then he finishes with, "But I trust you, and I will praise you because you've been good to me so far." Rather than the tracking the story and being able to see the prayer, the praying that goes along with it, especially in the Psalms that are superscripted, a Song of David when he feigned madness before Abimelech, that's great. You can grab that, plug it right into the story, and you can see not only what he did, but what he was thinking and how he was praying when he did it. That's gold because that matches the Psalms keep us honest. We really do think God has forgotten us. We really do want God to mash somebody into paste because of what they've done for us. That's real life. And the Psalms also often are reflective of the story. As you read through the Psalms, you will get an education in there are whole Psalms that are just story Psalms that recount what God did for Israel for 50 verses. Gets a little tough to sing that one. These are how do I describe this? It's worth taking a shot if you have the opportunity at teaching the whole story through. Take those chronological thread books, read them, extract the tellable stories, tell them, connect each one to the last one. If you have an opportunity, you have a venue where you can do that, do it. If you don't, and most of us don't, learn it for yourself. It'll change the way you tell simple stories like David and Goliath. And it'll change the way you handle the teaching moments because you bring the whole story into it. So the basic playbook, and this, by the way, I'm stealing shamelessly from the New Testament. This was part of what put me onto this. Is what do the New Testament authors do? Yes, I remember. I wasn't there, but I heard the story of a seminary prophet, Dallas Seminary. It's Bruce Waltke, Old Testament guy. He gets up in chapel. Somebody had made a joke about, and he's speaking on a verse out of the New Testament, which he never did. And so the guy who was introducing him had made a joke about it. He gets up and says, "I've read the New Testament. I like the New Testament. I like it so much because it reminds me of the Old Testament." Which it does. What does Paul do when he wants to show that we're saved by faith, by grace through faith, not of works? Well, guys, did you read about Abraham and how he believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness? Does the author of Hebrews do when he wants to show that Jesus has a superior priesthood? He goes straight back to Abraham and Melchizedek and goes, let's just do the math here. Abraham gives tithes to Melchizedek. Melchizedek blesses him. Which one is greater? Which one is lower? Aaron's descended from this guy. And Jesus, enter Psalm 110. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Do the math. It's all Old Testament. When they ask Jesus about, and this one's a really juicy one, this goes a long way. When they ask Jesus if it's okay to divorce your wife for just any reason at all, what does he do? Straight back to Genesis 2. Well, exactly how many women did God make in the garden? Just one? Golly, boys, let's think about that. And so one of the basic set of strategies that you use is you tell one story and the big story is contained in the little stories. With different emphases and different turns, the big story, to put it in a sentence, is about the son of a king who slays a dragon to win the hand of a princess and save the world. Adam had his shot. He messed it up. But the whole story is right there. Here's the snake. here's the man that God created. Here's the garden and the world that he's to protect, and he blows it. And then when God says, hey, Adam, you blew it, he goes, well, really, I'm the victim here, because it's that woman that you gave me. So he doesn't measure up. And we go the whole Old Testament hoping for somebody to slay the dragon already. And you have that David and Goliath. Seed of the woman, seed of the serpent. You can tell the whole Old Testament through that, through Genesis 3:15. Conflict between seed of the woman and seed of the serpent all the way through. So you have that big story reflected in the little story. You can tell the big story the way I did just now, but situate the choice. Am I going to keep this promise? I promised that I'd go over to Johnny's house, but that was before I found out that Susie's having a birthday party this weekend, and Susie's parents are rich and they have awesome party favors. Like what they get for party favors, I get for presents. I want to go to Susie, but I told Johnny that Johnny's not inviting to Susie's because Susie doesn't like him. Everybody else is going. Am I going to keep this promise or not? Well, what happens to people who keep promises in the story? What happens to people who break them? God says, Adam, don't eat off that tree. Adam says, okay, what's he do? What happened? Who do we trust? Adam didn't get the job done. Who did? Jesus. What did he do? What he said he was going to. Even when Peter gets right up in his face and says, no, you're not, you know, you're not going up to Jerusalem. You're not going to die. This is crazy talk. Stop it. Jesus says, Peter, get behind me. Jesus says, Satan, get behind me. So now, when you're making the decision, do I go to Johnny's house or do I go to Susie's birthday party, and your friends are going, go to Susie's birthday party. This is Jesus. This is Peter talking to Jesus. Are you going to do what you said you were going to do? Are you going to do what they're telling you to do? And so you take the teaching moment and you situate, you take the big story and you smash it onto the teaching moment. Because it really is, this is a moment in that big story. And this moment is supposed to reflect something. And sort of middling off between the two is to take a particular story like Jesus and Peter or David and Goliath or whatever and map it. Stick it into the present story and go, okay, who's playing the part of Jesus here? Who's playing the part of Peter? In a bullying situation, who's being David and who's being Goliath? And you find out you're always playing the part of Goliath. You need to think about that. I've got some resources for you at the bottom of the page there. I didn't want to leave you a whole bunch of websites, but all these folks do have websites. You can Google them and they'll come up. I gave you the one from Michael Bull because if you Google him, it won't come up. Questions or comments before we close?
I know sometimes I'll be going through and I'm like, wait a minute, I just read this. Like, you know, the parallel with the Chronicles. I'm like, So then I flip back and I'm like, oh, I did read this because it's parallel. But yeah, that's really helpful.
Okay, well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.